If you were with us like 3 weeks ago, we're going to do these monthly. Last week we moved it because of the first Thursday was the Chiefs game. Yeah. So tonight the only game was Washington versus Chicago. Nobody's interested in that game. So last month we spent time talking, if you remember, about the history. So we were looking at the rulers, the kingdoms, the sort of historical political world that built up. So we went from Alexander the Great on through the Herodian dynasty. So all the way to Herod Agrippa II that's mentioned in Acts. And we were trying to get sort of a historical framework for the Gospels. That's going to come in handy because we're going to encounter some of that history again tonight. And what we're looking at tonight is we're looking at the major groups behind the New Testament. Some of these we run into. We mentioned the Sadducees, the Pharisees often in the Gospels. We're going to talk tonight about the Essenes as well, too, that though they're not mentioned in the Gospels, are certainly a part of the world of the Gospels. And probably the thing that's most important to say from the beginning is it's easy to think of the Jewish people in the time of Jesus as a monolithic single thing. There was Jesus, and Jesus was teaching the Jews, and the Jews were responding to Jesus, or to think of the temple as all of the Jews loved the temple and went to the temple to worship. But the first century Jewish world is a massively complicated world. And if you remember how complex the history was from our last lecture, how there was civil war amongst the Druze. Remember the two Hasmonean brothers who were dividing and warring against each other for power and control. You have all sorts of opposition, those who side with Rome and are becoming more Hellenized, those are not. All of these produce very different groups with different political, different religious views. The world that Jesus is in and teaching in is a really complicated one for the Jewish people. It's probably better to talk about Judaisms than Judaism because many of these Jewish groups didn't consider the other groups to even be legitimate or actual. So we're going to get into some of that complexity, but we're going to focus a little bit. So a little bit of a roadmap. We're going to spend most of our time talking about the Sadducees, the Pharisees, and the Essenes. But I made just sort of a list. Some of these I may mention, but we won't get into. But at the time of Jesus, you have groups like the followers of John. We know from the book of Acts that that actually spread beyond the land of Israel, so that there are followers of John even after John. This seems to be a fairly large movement. You, of course, have the followers of Jesus that are making up this first century world. You have groups like the Zealots, which we'll talk a little bit about, subgroups of the Zealots like the Sicarii, who are politically active and motivated towards assassinations and political strategies. You have the Samaritans, which we've talked about before. I'm not going to talk about tonight, but of course, the Samaritans considered themselves to be the true Jewish expression with their own place of worship, Mount Gerizim, their own interpretation of the Torah. You have the Herodians we talked about. You have Jews who are supporting the Herodian dynasty. You have a group called the Bethusians, who are a breakoff of the Sadducees we'll talk about. You have within the Pharisaical movement, the rabbi tradition, you have competing voices within it. I'll talk about the houses of Hillel, the houses of Shammai. You don't need to know all these, but I put these up here just to begin making the point. There are a lot of people disagreeing, creating groups. There is conflict and disagreement. There is a lot going on when you say the groups of the New Testament. The other thing I put up here is there is this phrase called Am Ha'aretz, which just means people of the land. All of these groups that we're talking about, it's easy to think that every single person in the gospel who is a Jew is associating themselves with one of these groups. The truth is, these groups and the people who really identified with them are probably just a percentage, 10%, 15% of the larger population. You have a significant number of Jews who are just trying to survive. They're trying to grow enough crops and earn enough of a living and raise a family and avoid political and taxation issues. And so you have a lot of people who are just getting by and surviving. And actually, when you read some of these sources, particularly you get into the rabbinic sources, they actually will sort of look down on the people of the land for not being educated, for not having picked a side. So this is the world, very complicated, lots of groups constantly dividing, a lot of people that are just sort of uninterested in the questions. And I was trying to think of the right way to frame this. And if you were to do a presentation on, you know, if you're 2,000 years from now and you look back at 2023 and somebody says, could you do a presentation on the groups that made up America in 2023? Yeah, it's really complicated. So there's things you could do. You could... You could talk about geography, right? Like to be a part of the Ozarks is distinct from the South, which is distinct from the Midwest. Some of us in the Ozarks would even like to draw distinctions within the Ozarks. You could talk about religious views, the different makeups of sometimes even categorized by race or geography, but also tradition, non-religious, religious. I mean, just think about trying to explain the various groups within evangelicalism. Or take just the Pentecostal groups or Baptist groups or Lutheran groups, right? Then you could talk about politics. So you could talk about how many people are actually Republicans and Democrats versus how many people just say, well, I throw my hat in with Republicans or Democrats. What is a Republican and Democrat? These are the kinds of questions you get into when you start talking about Pharisees, Sadducees, Essenes, the people of the land. Just how do you describe these groups? How big are they? Somebody may just be a common person, but they tend to support one group over the other. I put this up just to say it's complicated. And perhaps what also makes it complicated in the first century is you don't have any idea of the separation of church and state. So your religious views have political implications, and often your religious and political views are also tied to your family history, your family name, the place that you live. So to ask a question about, we encounter a Pharisee in the gospel, who is the Pharisee? Who is the Sadducees? It's a little bit of a complicated question. And if you get nothing out of tonight's lecture, this will be one of my concluding points, but you leave here and say, there is an entirely complex world in which Jesus is entering in conversations. That's to some degree enough for you to take away from tonight, to understand there's far more going on with these groups that the Bible actually, I think, pretty accurately depicts and understands this complexity behind. And so we'll get into that. One of the lectures we've got coming up is we're going to do a whole night on different sources, extra biblical sources, so writings and books that help us kind of read and understand what's happening in the Bible. And one of the most important, in some ways, we probably could have done that lecture earlier, but one of the most important sources is Josephus. You've probably heard me on Sundays mention Josephus. It's worth us pausing because when it comes to the Sadducees, the Pharisees, and the Essenes, by far outside of the Bible, and the Bible really just sort of mentions these people, Josephus is one of the only writers we have that really explores who these groups were and gives us descriptions of them. Philo, who is also writing from Egypt, a Jew, he gives us a little bit, but Josephus is the largest. Josephus, this is going to also raise the other problem here. Josephus describes himself as a Pharisee. So he comes with already an agenda. But beyond that, Josephus was a Jew living in the land of Israel. During the great Jewish revolt that led to the destruction of the temple, destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD, he was actually a military leader, an officer with a detachment of Jewish fighters in the region of Galilee. They were pretty quickly surrounded, and he actually surrendered to the Romans and actually, depending on the story, struck some sort of a plea deal with the Romans to spare his life in exchange for him being a kind of cultural ambassador or advisor for understanding the Jewish people. The Jews at the time considered him a traitor, that he turned his back on his own people and joined the Romans. I'll leave you to read Josephus and determine. He wrote a whole biography of his own life, so you can dig into the question. But he is at Jerusalem in 70 AD to watch the destruction. He ends up going back with the Romans to Rome, where they actually give him a place to live. He ends up writing several books, one of them, The Antiquity of the Jews, which tells the story of the Jewish people. And he writes extensively about the first century world. So he tells us outside of the Bible a lot about the world in which Jesus was teaching. One of the challenges is most of the Jews didn't consider him credible because they considered him a traitor. He had sided with Rome. And he was writing, most people believed, to show the Romans a positive image of the Jewish people and religion. He was trying to compare Judaism and make it plausible for the Romans to accept it within a Roman worldview. So he definitely comes with an agenda. He is remembered partly because Christian scribes continued translating and passing on Josephus' works, is why we have it. But for anybody studying the world of the first century, you're going to find yourself over and over in Josephus, and we're going to turn to it pretty heavily for asking this question about Pharisees, Sadducees, and Essenes. So to Josephus. This is what Josephus says in his Antiquities of the Jewish People, Book 18. The Jews for a great while had three sects of philosophy peculiar to themselves, the sect of the Essenes and the sect of the Sadducees, and the third sort of opinions was that of those called Pharisees, of which sects, although I have already spoken in the second book of the Jewish Wars, yet I will little touch upon them now. So he gives us these descriptions of these three groups that he describes as the primary groups, although he's going to talk about more groups in his histories as well, too. But he calls these, you notice he's writing for a Roman audience, he calls these philosophies, right? He's trying to explain these Jewish groups to what's probably a Roman audience. And he describes them as these three. And so we're going to take his three groups and look at them tonight, too. So the first group we want to talk about is the Sadducees. In Hebrew, you get the word zadakim, which comes from the word zadok. This is a good place for us to start. Do you remember when David set all the materials up to build the temple? Solomon completes the temple. The first high priest that's named in the new temple was the high priest Zadok. And if you remember the way the high priesthood was supposed to be handed down, it was hereditary. It was passed from father to son. So you should have a descendants from that first priest in the first temple, the Zadokites, who passed that on down. We get this idea of Sadducees from the Hebrew word Zadokites, or Zadokim, the plural in Hebrew. If you go back to that lecture we had last time on the history, you'll remember that this lineage of the priests from father to son gets interrupted. You'll remember it gets interrupted under the Seleucid kingdom as they begin to put a stop to Jewish worship. And then you have that revolution of the Hasmoneans, you remember, that come to power, Judas Maccabeus, the Hasmoneans, who end up taking power. And those Hasmoneans begin to place themselves as high priests. So even though we don't know for sure if the Hasmoneans were descendants of Zadok, but we do know that, if you remember last time, they started not only calling themselves high priests, but also calling themselves kings. They took on this dual title that they weren't supposed to. And we know that there was a lot of these groups, the Sadducees, the Pharisees, the Essenes, they all seemed to emerge out of this period of the Hasmonean rule. There was questions about, should the Hasmoneans be high priests? Should the Hasmoneans be kings and priests? And the way they were disrupting the establishment of the Zadokite families that had been passed down. So you have this sort of fragmenting that happens whenever that priesthood gets interrupted. By the time you get into the Herodian dynasty, if you remember, they start basically selling off the high priesthood to whoever bribes or whoever Rome sees as most manipulative for the position. And so the whole question of who is high priest and is the high priest a legitimate high priest becomes a big point of differentiation for these groups. There's probably three groups at this moment that break off. We know there was a group called the Onaiads who actually go to Egypt and set up a second temple in Egypt and began to practice the Jewish faith at a temple in Egypt. That was closed down by Vespasian after the destruction in 70 AD, a kind of suppression across the Roman Empire of the Jews. One of the other groups was probably the Sadducees who remained in Jerusalem and continued to try to articulate for their own family lineage their place within the temple worship. And probably the third break off of that is the Essenes, who we'll talk about in a little bit, who basically reject the temple altogether and will move out into the desert, out into the wilderness. But this is that group, the Sadducees, who track their identity according to their family lineage all the way back to that first priest, Zadok, in the first temple that Solomon built. So let's read. Josephus talks about them. So again, that's from that same passage we've been reading in Josephus. Josephus says, "But the doctrine of the Sadducees is this, that souls die with the bodies, nor do they regard the observation of anything besides what the law enjoins them." We'll talk about these things in a moment. "But for they think it is an instance of virtue to dispute with those teachers of philosophy with whom they frequent. But this doctrine is received by a few, yet by those still of the greatest dignity. But they are able to do almost nothing of themselves, for when they become magistrates, they are unwillingly and by force sometimes obliged to be. They addict themselves to the notions of the Pharisees because the multitude would not otherwise bear them." So let's summarize this a little bit, what Josephus is telling us about this group. So he tells us the Sadducees is probably the smallest of these three groups. So he says specifically there that they're not many in number, but they're of dignified number. They're of influential number. If you think about the fact that these are old, established families that track their lineage back to that important high priest position, these are priestly families who have been in Jerusalem for generations, who are controlling the temple and the temple's wealth, the Sadducees end up incredibly wealthy. You think of them as the sort of aristocracy, right? The royal families and the important families that make up Jewish society. So they're small in number, but they're extremely wealthy. They most often are associated with control of the temple. So whether that's the actual worship of the temple or the mechanisms of the temple. And we know that they make up the majority of the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin shows up in the New Testament as that Jewish ruling body. So the Romans in the first century had taken over governing, but they were allowed to have this standing Sanhedrin government that functioned out of the temple that would listen to judicial cases related to religion or any of the sort of cultural issues that the Romans didn't have laws on. And the Sadducees made up the significant majority of that Sanhedrin council. But the other thing we learn about them from Josephus is that although they had wealth and power and influence, they were not popular among the people. That was the point Josephus was making, that if they tried to do just what they wanted, the people wouldn't have had it. So they often aligned themselves with the Pharisees, even though they disagreed with the Pharisees, because, and this is a good way of thinking of the Sadducees, it was the politically shrewd thing for them to do to keep control. The Sadducees are minority, they're wealthy, they're very interested in how do we maintain our position of authority over the temple. So they're in many ways both religious, but also you see the political motivation. A few things else Josephus tells us about them. They believe in the Torah only. Only what the law enjoined them to do was the way Josephus put it. So in other words, when we talk about the Hebrew Bible or the Old Testament, you have the law, the first five books of Moses, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. That's known as the Torah or the law. And then you have, according to the Hebrew Bible, the prophets and the writings. The Sadducees did not believe the prophets and the writings were scriptural. The only thing they read and studied and believed had any sort of religious bearing on them were the five books of Moses. So because of that, they developed certain theological convictions or teachings that will be distinct from the Pharisees, distinct from Jesus, which we're going to look at. They have no recorded, and this will be an important word, oral tradition. We're going to talk a lot about oral tradition with the Pharisees, the sort of ideas of how we keep the law and how the law should be protected. One of the challenges in talking about the Sadducees is we don't have any written documents from the Sadducees. Remember I said Josephus describes himself as a Pharisee. The Jewish books that will come after the fall of the temple in the rabbinic tradition, the Mishnah and the Tosefta and the Talmud, they all, we think, represent mostly a Pharisaical movement. So the Sadducees, we don't have the Sadducees handbook of religious practice to be able to understand. But it seems like, based on Josephus, the sources, the New Testament, they're interested in only the Torah, and they don't see any need to keep an oral tradition. So because of only reading the Torah, they believe there's no resurrection and there's no afterlife. That might surprise you a little bit, but we're going to see this in the New Testament. They believed that when you died, you died. There was no afterlife, no reward. They also, because they did not see, and if you go read the first five books of the Bible, there are passages that if you believe in the in eternal life and resurrection, you can see it. But there isn't a defined theology of the afterlife in the first five books of the Bible. That's why they began to question it. They argued about this in the first century, but they didn't see enough of one developed for them to believe it. They also did not see in the first five books a detailed teaching on angels or demons or extra human beings. So they had no view of anything angelic, which this will become important to other groups. And they also believed there was complete free will. So in other words, God has sort of created this universe. He's given us his law that we should live by, and it's up to us to either live by it and so live well, or to not and reap the consequences in this life, but none eternal. So a little bit of the summary on the Sadducees. I use the word a conservative party, and I mean this word in that they are interested in preserving the status quo. They have wealth. They have a position of authority. They're a minority position, so they're most interested in how do we protect that current position that we have. And because of that, they seem early on willing to side with the Hasmoneans, like, hey, we got kicked out by them, but let's make the best of it so we can keep what influence we have. They're very quick to support the Romans. They seem to be the most willing to negotiate with the Romans to sort of pick up whatever they need to keep the peace. Because they're really interested in preserving their power in the temple, they're interested in preserving their wealth. I think that's the right image to take away of the Sadducees. They do show up in the New Testament, and I think knowing that description we just looked at from Josephus will help you make sense of some of the things you encounter when the Sadducees show up. So a couple of passages I want to read. This comes from Mark chapter 12. And the Sadducees came to him, this is Jesus. Notice what Mark records. The Sadducees came to him who say there is no resurrection. Right? We know why they say that, because they're only reading the Torah, the first five books. Josephus tells us this is exactly what the Sadducees believed. And they ask him the question saying, teacher, what do they appeal to? Moses wrote for us that if a man's brother dies and leaves a wife, but leaves no children, the man must take the widow and raise up offspring of his brother. There were seven brothers. The first took a wife, and when he died, left no offspring. And the second took her and died, leaving no offspring. And the third likewise. And the seven left no offspring. Last of all, the woman also died. In the resurrection, when they rise again, which we know they don't actually believe, whose wife will she be? For the seven had her as wife. You see what they're doing to Jesus. They're saying, Jesus, you believe in resurrection. Let's ask you a question. They don't believe. They're asking this question to try to trip Jesus up and to prove the idea of the resurrection is ridiculous. And Jesus said to them, is this not the reason you are wrong? Because you know neither the scriptures nor the power of God. Quite a comeback for the Sadducees, right? Power of God is in some ways temple language too, right? This is, you may have all the power and the wealth of the temple, but you don't know the actual presence, the power of God. And when he says you know neither scripture, he's alluding to the fact that you don't read the whole scriptures. You've not accepted all of the scriptures of God. I think this is fascinating. The image we get of Josephus telling us about the Sadducees fits exactly what we encounter when Jesus is having conversations with the Sadducees. You get a similar conversation in Acts chapter 4. And they were speaking to the people, and the priests and the captain of the temple and the Sadducees came upon them. So this is early Christians, Acts chapter 4. So they're in the temple talking about Jesus post his resurrection and ascension. And greatly annoyed because they were teaching the people and proclaiming in Jesus the resurrection from the dead. Well, you understand exactly why the Sadducees are particularly upset here, because they're drawing people away from the temple and power, but particularly because they're talking about Jesus being resurrected, which we know is one of the big disputed disagreements between the Sadducees and Pharisees in the first century. So a little bit of a picture. The Sadducees do not come up nearly as often in the New Testament as the Pharisees do. But when you encounter them, it's interesting. It seems to be these very questions, appeals to Moses, questions about resurrection, questions about the temple and worship. That's Sadducees. We'll go into the Pharisees. And at the end, if you've got questions, we'll come back and talk about them too. So Pharisees, it's hard to find good images for all of these. They go wrong in one of two ways. They either all look medieval paintings, right? Because they didn't know what dress looked like. Or a lot of these are like from the 1800s. People started traveling to the Holy Lands for the first time and they encountered the Ottoman Empire. And so they started painting everybody to look like they were Arabic or Muslim in dress. But the reason I liked this one for the Pharisees is they're wearing the phylacteries or the tefillin, which we'll talk about in a second. But the Pharisees, we get their name. Basically, the Pharisees in Hebrew would be the Prushim, which means in Hebrew to separate or to be separate. Probably a name, you know, Christians was the early name was kind of a pejorative, right? Like little Christ, people started calling them that as kind of mocking. They think that's what this is for the Pharisees too. The Pharisees don't call themselves Pharisees. They call themselves friend or brother when they're referring to each other, or they'll call each other teacher or sometimes rabbi. But this name Pharisee is probably a pejorative, the ones who separate themselves, maybe who think they're better than everyone else. We're not entirely sure where they get the name. But we do know that both Josephus, as we talked about, considered himself a Pharisee. Paul, from the New Testament, tells us that he, in his training and upbringing, was one of the Pharisees. And the reason I did like this picture is you get a place in Matthew 23 where you read, talking about the Pharisees, they do all their deeds to be seen by others, for they make their phylacteries broad and their fringes long. So this is phylacteries, if you've ever seen, they still do this in modern Judaism, so you'll take a little box, a leather box that has scripture on little scrolls inside of it. And it comes from the Old Testament command that you're supposed to place the law over your eyes and around your arm or close to your heart. So they'll place it on their arm and then wrap a leather strap around their arm and tie the one around their head, right? Normally it's practiced just in prayer, but the Pharisees would often wear them around. And Jesus is making the point that the Pharisees would even make their tefillin, their phylacteries, larger than most people did so that people could see them, and that they would wear longer fringe on their cloak. So Jesus recognized them because they're publicly demonstrating their acts, their purity. The Sadducees would never have been walking around in tefillin. They probably wouldn't have even ever prayed with them because they read those scriptures and said, clearly God is using this as an image, right? His law should be on your heart and in your mind. But the Pharisees say, no, it says put his law on your heart and on your mind. So we'll literally put little scrolls of scripture over our heads and around our arms. And you're going to get a lot of this with the Pharisees, these disagreements between the Sadducees and the Pharisees on how literal. So let's get Josephus's take on the Pharisees. Now, for the Pharisees, they live meanly and despise delicacies and diet, and they follow the contract of reason. And what that prescribes to them is good for them, they do. They think they ought earnestly to strive to observe reason's dictates for practice. They also pay respect to such as are in years, nor are they so bold as to contradict them in anything which they have introduced. So this high degree of honor for elders and an unwillingness to contradict teachers. And when they determine that all things are done by fate, they do not take away the freedom from men of acting as they think fit, since their notion is that it hath pleased God to make a temperament, whereby what he wills is done, but so that the will of man can act virtuously and viciously. They also believe that souls have an immortal vigor in them, and that under the earth there will be rewards or punishments. You're already hearing a distinction from the Sadducees. Accordingly, as they have lived virtuously or viciously in this life, and the latter are to be detained in an everlasting prison, but that the former shall have power to revive and live again, on account of which doctrines they are able greatly to persuade the body of the people. And whatsoever they do about divine worship, prayers, and sacrifices, they perform them according to their direction, insomuch that the cities give great attestation to them on account of their entire virtuous conduct, both in the actions of their lives and their discourses also. So let's summarize that a little bit. The Pharisees are popular with the people. Josephus, I think the number he gives is that, I think he says there were 6,000 Pharisees. So this number is not a huge number. And again, there's questions here about what does it mean to be a Pharisee? Is this like there's a certain group of them that are card-carrying, right, members of the Pharisees, and then there's a whole lot who just sort of lean Pharisees? We don't know. But regardless, however many there were, they were popular and had sway over the people. People tended to respect the Pharisees, to listen to the Pharisees on their teaching. They also, and I don't love using this line, middle class, but they are considered the merchant class. So the Sadducees tend to be wealthier. The Pharisees tend to not be, this is not the everyday people of the land. They tend to be kind of merchant class. Remember, these are the people who are dedicating their lives to studying the law and practicing the law. So they have some sort of stability, whether it's by a benefactor or the community at large. It's not true that all rich people were Sadducees and all middle-class people were Pharisees. It's not that simple, but they tended to be more associated with this class. They also centered less around the temple complex, although they will have significant impact on the temple because of the mass of people that supported them. And we also know they had seats on the Sanhedrin. So for instance, do you remember in John when Nicodemus comes to Jesus? He's one of the rulers in Jerusalem, but he describes himself as a Pharisee. So again, it's more complicated than just they had the towns, the Sadducees had Jerusalem. There's a mix here. But by and large, they tended to be more centered around local communities. Their power base was more in the synagogues than it was the temple. They had seats on the Sanhedrin, but they tended to be more minority seats. When it comes to their teaching, of course, the Pharisees believe in the whole Old Testament Bible. So they're not Torah only. They believe in the prophets and the writings as well. They are also, which we're going to spend some time talking about, major proponents of oral tradition. They believe that God gave Moses two things, the written law, which we have in the Pentateuch, and they believe that God actually gave Moses the oral tradition, oral instructions on how that law was to be lived and kept, and that it was their job to teach that oral tradition, to add to that oral tradition where questions arose, and to keep that oral tradition as if it was the law given to Moses. They believe in resurrection, they believe in angels and demons. And they hold this interesting position, Josephus was describing it, where they believe that God foreknows all things, he sees all things, but he gives humans the experience of choosing in the midst of his foreknowledge, that human choice and divine knowledge can coexist, is the position that they held. The big thing that you need to talk about when you're talking about the Pharisees, because this is the thing that comes up with Jesus over and over, is the idea of the oral tradition. And so I want to dig into that a little bit, because when we see the Pharisees interacting with Jesus, by the way, they're not all negative. I think the conversation Jesus has with Nicodemus is an example of him being a Pharisee is not the question in that story. And there are certainly Pharisees who seem to come to him in a position of genuinely listening. He's defended by a Pharisee at one point. But this question of oral tradition is really where the controversy seems to usually arise. So this is a passage from the beginning of the Mishnah, which we'll talk about this again when we get into Jewish sources. The Mishnah was written down in about 200 AD. And it was the written down oral tradition. So all of the oral teaching that had been circulating from teachers to students, the oral tradition that most of these Pharisees would have memorized and been conversant in and discussed, right? Eventually it was written down, no longer oral, it was written. The first book to be written was the Mishnah. Then there was a book called the Tosefta, which is literally just means the additions. And then ultimately there will be the Talmud, which is a long tradition of reading and interpreting the Mishnah. But the Mishnah, we believe, is the oral tradition that takes us back into the time of Jesus. And so this is how you get in the Mishnah them describing the oral tradition. Moses received the Torah, This is the Pentateuch from Sinai, and committed it to Joshua, and Joshua to the elders, and the elders to the people, and the prophets to the men of the great assembly. And they said three things: be deliberate in judgment, raise up many disciples, and make a fence around the Torah. So these three things that they're being commanded to do. The first one, they said, be deliberate in judgment. So this is going to be the idea of determine how the law is to be kept. Make wise judgment and discussion so that you can fulfill the obligations of the Torah into later years. So let me give an example of this. The Torah says, honor your father and mother. Well, questions arise. What does it mean to honor your father and mother? And in what situations does other laws supersede the honoring of father and mother? Let me give you another example. There's nothing in the Old Testament Torah about flipping on a light switch. So, but there is a rule in the Torah that says you can't kindle a fire on the Sabbath. So rabbis throughout history, when electricity was invented, decided to make a judgment on, does it violate the law to turn on a light switch on Sabbath? Is that akin to kindling a fire on the Sabbath? And Jews have discussions to this day, and some say you can't, some say you can. But this is that idea of the law that Moses had has to be wisely discerned and applied as time passes to be able to live it, this oral tradition passed on. It needs to be taught to disciples, with the goal then of making a fence around the Torah. I think this is really important to getting the Pharisaic movement. We want to create rules and regulations that protect the laws of the Torah from being violated, which means if we can create a set of rules that keep us from getting to the rule of the Torah, right? If it says honor your father and mother, if we can set up enough rules to protect us from ever getting close enough to violating that law, we're better off for it. You get this idea of the accumulation or the buildup of tradition that begins to form around keeping the law. So let me give you an example from the New Testament. This is from Mark 7. Now, when the Pharisees gathered to him, Jesus, with some of the scribes who had come from Jerusalem, they saw that some of his disciples, Jesus' disciples, ate with hands that were defiled, that is, unwashed. And then we get this little parenthetical. For the Pharisees and all the Jews do not eat unless they wash their hands properly, holding to the tradition of the elders. And when they come from the marketplace, they do not eat unless they wash. And there are many other traditions that they observe, such as the washing of cups and pots and copper vessels and dining couches. And the Pharisees and the scribes asked him, why do your disciples not walk according to the tradition of the elders, but eat with defiled hands? Okay, so if you read this the first time, you would think this is just a Jewish question, right? Well, this is a Pharisaical question, right? The Sadducees didn't care about this. This is not in the Torah, and this isn't something that they saw as a practice, an evolved practice. There's no oral tradition built up for the Sadducees. But for the Pharisees, the historical record of how the Jews have practiced this and the traditions of the elders that have built up around it are as important to them. They are oral Torah, just like written Torah. So where do they get this? A couple places. Exodus 30. The Lord said to Moses, you shall also make a basin of bronze with its stand of bronze. This is in the passage of the construction of the tabernacle and the practices of worship in the tabernacle. And you shall put it between the tent of meeting and the altar, and you shall put water in it, with which Aaron and his sons shall wash their hands and their feet. When they go into the tent of the meeting, or when they come near the altar to minister, to burn a food offering to the Lord, they shall wash with water, so that they may not die. They shall wash with their hands and their feet, so that they may not die. It shall be a statute forever to them, even to him and to his offspring throughout their generations. Then you get this in Leviticus 15. Speak to the Israelites and say to them, when any man has an unusual bodily discharge, such as a discharge is unclean, whether it continues flowing from his body or is blocked, it will make him unclean. This is how this discharge will bring about uncleanness. Anyone the man with a discharge touches, without rinsing his hands with water, must wash their clothes and bathe with water, and they will be unclean till evening. So, the tradition of the teachers saw this, and they basically said to one another, okay, we've got a law here. What's interesting is this law, if you notice, is specifically about priests that are offering sacrifices in the temple. This is about the possibility of interacting with someone who's unclean, making you unclean without washing. But they're accumulating all of these teachings. And remember, what are their goals? Apply this to every area of life, build a fence around the Torah so we never get close to violating that. So out of these scriptures, a tradition begins to form that no Jew should eat without washing their hands, or they shouldn't practice any sort of religious act without washing their hands. So let me go to another place in the Mishnah. So this is the Mishnah. The Mishnah has chapters or tractates. This is the tractate Yadayim, which literally is hands, the tractate on hands or washing hands. So it ends up becoming a whole chapter in the oral tradition. And we'll get to the picture in a second. But in the Mishnah, that old oral tradition written down, hands become unclean and are made clean as far as the joint. How so? If he pours the water over the hands as far as the joint and pours the second water over the hands beyond the joint, and the latter flowed back to the hands, and the hands, I'm not going to read all of this, but I'm trying to make a point here. If he pours the first and the second water over the hands beyond the joint, and they flowed back to the hands, and the hands remain unclean. If he poured the first water over one of his hands and then changes his mind and pours the second water over both hands, this is what they were producing. They were basically trying to say, can we be 100% confident that we are fully and completely obeying the law? So this picture is actually, that's the western wall of the temple where you could go to today. And you'll see all outside of it, there are these fountains. And it's not a great picture. There's actually two handles on this cup. Many Jews have these today in their house. And they're made so that you can hold one handle while you wash one hand clean and then hold the other handle to wash the other hand clean. It's actually a way of following what is being described here and how you'll wash your hands. There's a whole procedure for this. And this is this tradition that's beginning to form up around how your hands should be washed. This is a later, so this is more of a modern commentary on the Mishnah. So it'd be like we would read a commentary on the Bible today. So this is a modern rabbi talking about this tradition. The rabbis required us to wash, so the taking up of hands, for two reasons. To be in good habit for the offering, which is they're thinking of off, not just this temple offering, but the eating of bread. Modern Jews consider the table at home and the meal a kind of replacement for the temple and the temple sacrifices, since there isn't a temple. When the laws of ritual purity were relevant for the priests, had to wash their hands before they ate this offering of the bread or the meat. So he's saying, that's that passage we read from Exodus. The priests used to have to do this. And since we're not always aware what our hands have touched, and maybe they touch something impure, and then they'll make the offering, the bread or the meat, impure, we want the Kohanim, the priests, to stay in this habit, even though nowadays they're all impure, and therefore they don't eat offerings. So the priests today can't be pure and can't eat offerings because we don't have a temple. But we want them to continue practicing this so that when the holy house is rebuilt speedily in our days, they'll keep the offering and eat pure. Those who are not priests must wash before they eat bread to reinforce the priests in this habit. So we've just decided as a Jewish community to keep the priests from ever being tempted not to do this. If the entire nation of Israel does this, then we'll know the priests are also doing it. For cleanliness and holiness, the rabbis found a hint to this in the verse, make yourself holy and be holy. Okay, this is a lot. I'm giving you all of this to try to say, this is the idea that formed, the things that the priests were required to do. Remember, Israel had gone through periods of exile in which the temple had been lost, in which they had recognized they were not being faithful to God. And the idea began to form. We saw this at the end of Nehemiah and Ezra. How can we be faithful to God's laws? How can we, not just priests in a temple somewhere, but as a nation of people, a holy people, how can we all live in such a way that God's blessing will be upon us as a nation? And I always want to be careful because it's easy to read these passages about which hand to pour the water and how and if, where it lands and think, oh my goodness, this is ridiculous. But these Pharisees are a people who are so committed to being faithful to God and so passionate about calling God's people to faithfulness that there is not a single area of their life they're not willing to bring into that lordship, that control. And Josephus tells us the people respected them for this. People were not walking around going, ah, the Pharisees, they drive us crazy with the rules. They respected the fact that these were people who had dedicated their life to holiness before God. Now, it's going to create challenges, right? And Jesus begins to recognize that just because all of the physical acts of holiness are there in the Pharisees doesn't mean that that actual heart of worship is still there for the Pharisees. And of course, the things that may have begun this passion in the oral tradition doesn't mean that as it's passed on, people continue to do it with that right heart of worship. So in that passage from Mark chapter 7 that we were looking at, where they were saying, Jesus, how come your disciples don't wash their hands? And according to the tradition of the elders, Jesus answers this way. And he said to them, you have a fine way of rejecting the commandment of God in order to establish your tradition. So in other words, he's going to make the point, you're prioritizing your tradition over the actual commandment, which would have shocked them, right? They imagine every tradition is about keeping the commandments. Then he goes on, for Moses said, honor your father and mother, and whoever reviles father or mother must surely die. But you say, if a man tells his father or his mother, whatever you would have gained from me is korban, that is, given to God, then you no longer permit him to do anything for his father or mother, thus making void the word of God by your tradition that you have handed down, and many such things you do. Now, you read this in the Bible and you think, I have absolutely no idea what this is talking about or what is going on here, right? This idea of korban. This is, I made that point at the very beginning, that once you understand the complex Jewish conversations that are going on in the first century, you understand that often what Jesus is doing is wandering into conversations that were already taking place. He's right in the middle of one of these conversations. Jesus and the Pharisees both know that the regulations around washing hands are disputed in Judaism, that the Pharisees support it, that the Sadducees don't, that probably many of the common people didn't. Some said it was for priests, some said it was for everyone. They're drawing Jesus into a question, wanting his opinion on something that everybody knew was disputed. What Jesus does is turn around and brings up another one of these existing conversations, that there was a practice or a question circulating in Judaism about the idea of calling something korban in Hebrew, or given over to God. Something given over to God is something that's been dedicated. But the rabbis will tell us in later writings that there was a way of sort of saying this is korban, became a common saying. You would make like a snap oath, like, I swear I'll never do that for you, right? That this was happening, where children would get angry with their parents, and they would basically make a pledge, I'll never give you anything, it's dedicated to God instead. And this whole argument develops about which law supersedes. If you made an oath and you backtrack on that oath, then you violated the law. And so the Pharisees would say, if you make an oath, even in a moment of anger or frustration with a parent, and you say, korban, that's not for you anymore, I've dedicated it to God, they would say you have to honor that word. You made a commitment, you swore it, you have to do it. It supersedes your commitment to father and mother. Jesus comes along and says, you're so quick to turn to your traditions and your judgments that you will invalidate the law, honor your father and mother, just because in your judgments you think this korban tradition supersedes it. Does that begin to make a little sense? Here, I have my one cultural analysis. The meme that often goes around, no soup for you. Have you seen this? The soup Nazi? A commentator drug this out because he said this is actually an Iranian tradition. This chef was based on an actual Iranian chef in New York City who used to say, not for you, right? And that it was a kind of like, in Jesus's day, this was probably a saying, right? No soup for you. Korban, like, I won't ever give it to you. It's dedicated to God instead. And this becomes a whole question that Jesus now turns on them and says, don't you see how you're not even keeping the actual law anymore? Because you've lost so much of the sense of the law in these debates and conversations you're having. So a parallel example, again, from the Mishnah. A man spots a crowd of people eating figs from his trees and shouts, korban to you, no figs for you, right? This is that idea. So those are dedicated to God. You can't have them. What if his father and brothers are in the crowd? This is the same question Jesus was asking. Remember, you honor your father and mother, but you say korban. The Mishnah's having the same discussion. The disciples of Shammai ruled everyone is prohibited from eating the figs except the family. So Shammai decides the curse holds for everyone, but father and mother supersede it so they can still eat. But the disciples of Hillel ruled, no, everyone is permitted to eat the figs. The whole thing is invalidated. My point is to say, actually, they end up siding with Jesus, which is interesting here. They hold to some degree the same position Jesus holds. But when you read that in the New Testament, it's kind of like, what in the world is going on here? Or you think, these crazy Pharisees with all their rules. Jesus is wading into conversations that were circulating around these religious groups within Judaism. All that to say, if you're going to read the Gospels and understand the conversations Jesus is having, you can't really do that well without being at least somewhat familiar with these conversations that are happening around Jesus. So that's my quick introduction to the oral tradition, to Jesus' conversations with the Pharisees, to summarize the Pharisees a little bit. Constant debates and discussions. You see this throughout the Pharisaic tradition. They don't always agree with each other. In that last quote, you get the position of Shammai and Hillel, which are two different schools or houses within the Pharisaic tradition. The Talmud, as you get into it, and the Mishnah is really interesting because they will record both the majority and the minority positions. So when you read these debates on these oral traditions, it'll tell you this rabbi taught this, but this rabbi also taught this. They'll give you actually both views because this is a big part of the ongoing discussions. The Pharisees tended to be scholarly and oral focused. They're really interested. This is what they enjoy doing, is sitting around and from their memorization of oral tradition, debating these minute details of how to best fulfill the law. And again, don't cast them out and think this drove everyone crazy. The people loved this. They respected this. They saw this as something that was honorable. The question about Jesus and the Pharisees, there's this idea of the rule of minimal differences, or sometimes it'll get called the narcissism of minimal differences. This is the idea that we tend to disagree most strongly with the people we are closest aligned with, right? So you see this a lot in the ancient writings. We'll see it in the Essenes. They write with more passion against the Jews who are closest to them than they do Rome, because everybody knows they're opposed to Rome, right? They don't need to draw that distinction. I think you have a lot of this going on with Jesus. Jesus interacts with the Pharisees more than anyone else, partly because the Pharisees are around in Galilee, they're around in these synagogues, they're around in these local communities, but I think also because Jesus, in many ways, he holds the same view of Scripture, that all of Scripture is inspired, not just the Torah, like the Pharisees. He does believe in a life that is completely dedicated to obeying the law. He also believes in the idea that teachers should call disciples. He's using a kind of Pharisaic rabbinical model for how he's leading his own movement. There's going to be connections between the Essenes and Christians as well, too. It's not as if Jesus was a Pharisee. Remember, it's more complicated than that. But I think the reason Jesus so often has these heated conversations with the Pharisees is because they have so much in common, that it has a way of highlighting or drawing out where those differences are strongest. Does that make sense, this idea? You've encountered this idea before, too? This is probably your own family, by the way, right? So the people in your family you have the most heated conversations with because you have so much in common, it really highlights the things you don't have in common. And I think that's a little bit what you have going on here.
It'd be fair to say that they're most frustrated because of that, you know, they got so much right, and yet they're so stubborn.
Yeah.
They won't take the next step.
Well, Jesus' criticism of them almost always... It seems to be that their heart is not right in these things. Jesus will call them hypocrites, which is always, I think, interesting, because when we think of a hypocrite, we think of somebody who says one thing and does another. That's not what Jesus means by hypocrite, because the Pharisees are doing all of the things they're saying. What he means is you're so concerned about what you're doing that you've stopped thinking about the heart or the reason for doing it. And you say you're doing these things for a reason that isn't actually what's motivating you. I think that's what Jesus is getting at. So I think a lot of what Jesus is trying to do with the Pharisees is draw them back into a deeper question of, why do these traditions matter? Why do you keep up these things? And be careful about making your phylacteries large and your fringes long, right? That's that great parable of the Pharisee who, you know, thank you for not making me like these common people, the Hama Arats, the people of the land, the uneducated, ignorant people that don't know how to worship you, that because of their knowledge, they've actually begun to miss a little bit of the heart of what Jesus has come to offer. I want to say one word about the scribes. You'll often read the phrase, the scribes and the Pharisees. The scribes don't seem to be any kind of like organized political movement. It's not like you have Essenes, Pharisees, and then this other thing called the scribes. The scribes are basically a group of people who have dedicated themselves to studying the law and applying the law. And they're probably scribes working within all of these movements. You probably have scribes working within the Sadducee movement. You certainly have scribes who are working in with the Pharisees or seem to be aligned with the Pharisees. You probably also have scribes that don't align themselves with any of these parties, but are there trying to make just rulings. Probably some translations call them lawyers. They're probably functioning in some places, doing legal documents within cities and communities. Remember, there's no idea of a legal document that's not also religious. These things are all one and the same. So they're understanding the law and applying that through legal agreements. And you also do probably have some of them that are working within the temple structure. They're official scribes working. You have some that are teaching in synagogues. Scribe seems to be a really broad term for anybody who's taken up the occupation of studying the law, studying the Torah. And so you get that phrase a lot, scribes and Pharisees. They're not synonymous, but they seem to, in a lot of places, have overlap. We can talk more about it in questions. So the last group we want to look at is the Essenes. The Essenes are not mentioned in the Bible, but I bring them up because partly Josephus does, but also because I think there's some really important things. We're going to do a whole lecture on the Dead Sea Scrolls, which is one of my favorite topics. And most scholars agree that the Dead Sea Scrolls at Qumran are an Essene community, which we'll look at in a minute. And so there's a lot of research, a lot of writing on the Essenes. And because of this basically massive library that was uncovered at the Dead Sea in these caves, we know more about the Essenes from their own writing in that time period, the first century, than really any of these other groups. So they're a great window. I said when we were talking about the Sadducees, the Essenes are probably a breakoff group from that lineage of the Zadokite priests in Jerusalem, that whenever the Hasmoneans take control, they probably splinter off and break off altogether. There's some of the Zadokites who basically negotiate with the Hasmoneans to hold power, and there are some of the Zadokites, at least who started the Essene movement, they don't seem to have all been Zadokites, but who basically decided to leave Jerusalem and set up their own religious community in the wilderness. And so we'll talk a little bit about that as we get into it. But Josephus's description of them is this. The doctrine of the Essenes is this, that all things are best ascribed to God. They teach the immortality of the soul and esteem that the rewards of righteousness are to be earnestly striven for. And when they send what they have dedicated to God into the temple, they do not offer sacrifices because they have more pure lustrations of their own. They've rejected temple worship, we'll talk about. On which account they are excluded from the common court of the temple. They don't hold any positions in the Sanhedrin, but offer their sacrifices themselves. Yet this is their course of life, better than that of any other man, and they entirely addict themselves to husbandry, so they're living off the land and raising their own livestock. It also deserves our admiration, how much they exceed all other men that addict themselves to virtue. And this is righteousness, and indeed to such a degree that it hath never appeared among any other men, neither Greeks nor barbarians, not for a little time, so hath it endured a long while among them. This is demonstrated by that institution of theirs, which will not suffer anything to hinder them from having all things in common. They basically abandon all possessions and live in common with one another. The highest level of virtue, he says, above anything seen in the Greeks or barbarians. So that a rich man enjoys no more of his own wealth than he who hath nothing at all. There are about 4,000 men that live in this way, and neither marry wives nor are desirous to keep servants, as thinking the latter tempts men to be unjust, and the former gives the handle to domestic quarrels, but as they live by themselves, they minister one to another. They also appoint certain stewards to receive the incomes of their revenues and the fruits of the ground, such as are good to men and priests, who are to get their corn and their food ready for them. They none of them differ from others of the Essenes in their way of living. So let's summarize it. They are known as being the most devout, the most serious about how they live. They share in a kind of common life. Whenever you would become an Essene, which you could become one, you would bring all of your wealth and entrust it over to the community, and it would no longer be yours. You would empty yourself of all possessions. They had completely rejected the temple. They were no longer worshiping in the temple, going up to the temple. They actually had, which we'll get into when we do the Dead Sea Scrolls, they had their own calendar system, their own way of dating and keeping the religious festivals. They played no religious or political role. I mean, they had completely separated themselves from Jerusalem. You get, most often when you read about the Essenes, you'll talk about Qumran. So you have Jerusalem. If you go down to the Dead Sea, you have Qumran and the series of caves where they found the Dead Sea Scrolls. So we know there was a Essene community living there. Again, we'll talk more about this, but it seems like they had even structured Qumran, that settlement, as an alternative temple, that they had set it up kind of as not an actual temple with sacrifices, but a place. It's shaped like the temple, but they live and share meals together as a way of acting out the practices of the temple. But Josephus tells us, Philo also writes about, that there were Essenes living in all the major cities. So in Jerusalem, there's a place Josephus talks about, the Essene Gate, or the Gate of the Essenes, that Herod may have even broken into one of the walls and given a special gate because the Essenes had gathered in a place within Jerusalem that gave them access in and out of the temple of their own. One of my favorite things to talk about with the Essenes is they had very precise restroom habits. So they believed that you should not use the restroom inside Jerusalem because it was unholy. They had special practices about how to dig latrines and privacy. They also did not believe that you should use the restroom on the Sabbath. So you would hold it on the Sabbath. Josephus and Philo both write about this because even in the ancient world, people were like, this is crazy, but they do this. And this may be part of the reason that they have their own gate, because they're leaving Jerusalem to actually use latrines outside of the city and to come back in. Really interesting. We can get into that later too. The Essenes have an apocalyptic focus. Of all these groups, if you read the documents written at Qumran, it's about the war of the sons of light against the war of the sons of darkness. They believe two messiahs are coming, a political kingly messiah and also a high priest messiah. They believe in angels and demons and heavenly armies that are returning. A lot of their writing is apocalyptic. They have this extreme devotion to the law down to how they use the restroom. They absolutely believe in resurrection and the rewards. They also believe that, by the way, if you're not an Essene, there are no rewards. You're the enemy. I mean, they are devout in themselves being the only genuine expression of Judaism. And all things are by fate. So they have a complete view that God has ordained all things, including their salvation and the destruction of others. They are extremely hostile to the Pharisees. And I think this is good because it tells us something about how people saw the Pharisees as well. They use this phrase, seeker of smooth things. This is how they describe the Pharisees in their documents, which is a pun. So the Hebrew, Dorshe Halakot. Halakot means the law, so the keepers of the law. But the word here, Halakot, you notice the only difference is you get a kaf and a kof, or kaf and a kof. There's one letter difference, but they sound the exact same. So the words sound the same, but they're spelled slightly different. And they make the meaning either mean seekers of the law or seekers of smooth things. So it's a pun making fun of the Pharisees. And they're saying those people that seem to be so obsessed with the law, the Essene position on the Pharisees was, you're actually just looking for outs. You're looking for ways to get what you want. You're manipulating the law so that you can make it smoother for yourself and appealing to people in yourself. They thought the Pharisees, get this, were too lax in how they kept the law. So all that stuff we just went through, this is why I think it's important that Pharisees get misrepresented, right? The Pharisees were not legalist, extreme conservatives. They would have been considered the modernists, the people who were finding how to live the law in the day in a way that was acceptable to the large amount of people. The real sort of extreme law, we're going to keep every possible detail, are the Essenes, who separate themselves completely. They also have one of the major ideas for the Essenes that I think is really important is this idea of them separating themselves from the temple. So these documents are from the Dead Sea Scrolls. Anytime you see a number with a Q, that's referring to the cave that it was found in. So the fourth cave, this is the 174th fragment in the fourth cave, and it's a midrash, a commentary on the last days. This is 1Q Habakkuk Pesher. That's a commentary on Habakkuk from cave one. That's how the naming works. But these two statements you get, he commanded that a sanctuary of men be built for himself in order to offer up to him like the smoke of incense, the works of the law. Or in this other Habakkuk Pesher, the condemned house, this is talking about the temple, is a city of vanity, Jerusalem. They perform a service for vanity for the sake of its own glory. Now, this is a huge idea. When you read the Bible and think all the Jews are going up to the temple to worship, you have a whole priestly community who, before Jesus, is already saying that what God wants from them is to build a sanctuary of men who will offer up smoke, a burnt offering of incense that's actually obedience to the law. You could think of this as the spiritualizing of the temple and of sacrifice. They've rejected sacrifice in the temple. They're going to make themselves as a community of believers a temple, and they're going to offer sacrifice through their own obedience because they've rejected the temple. Well, you get language like this when the Christians come along and start talking about being built into a temple, or Jesus will say things like these temple stones will be torn down, right? So 1 Corinthians, don't you know that you yourselves are God's temple and that God's spirit dwells in your midst? Or Luke 21, then as some spoke of the temple, how it was adorned with beautiful stones and donations, Jesus said, these things which you see, the days will come in which not one stone shall be left upon another, and so it shall be thrown down. If you just read this, you would think, ah, Jesus is the one voice against the temple. Everybody's going up to the temple to worship, and Jesus is against it. There is a massive movement within Judaism that is already recognizing the corruption of the temple, rejecting the temple. There are Essenes who are already writing and talking about how what God is doing is creating a new temple of believers who are worshiping through obedience. So when Jesus and the Christians begin to take a position like this, that the temple has been rejected and God is doing a new thing and building believers, this is very much a part of how Judaism was moving, how some within Judaism were thinking. This fits into the broader conversations that were happening in Judaism. All right, we're almost done. The last group, which I'm just going to give you one note on, is the Zealots. The Zealots are not a single group. The Zealots, as you probably heard before, the Zealots are a political movement that are trying to overthrow Roman occupation. They probably have pretty diverse religious views, although Josephus writes about the Zealots that they agree in all things with the Pharisaic notions, that they're basically Pharisees in theology, but they have an inviolable attachment to liberty and say that God is to be their only ruler and Lord. In other words, they will not compromise with Rome. They will not bow to Rome. They will not recognize Roman power. And so the Zealots become, particularly as we move closer to the revolt that leads up to the destruction in 70, they become more and more active, opposing some of the most extremes, assassinating. So the Zealots, the right way to think of them, do you remember the story? I think it's in Numbers, right? Where Phinehas basically goes into the tent and spears the man and woman who are violating the law. And it talks about his zeal for the Lord. This is the Zealot idea. Action primarily through military might to take back. It's through that zealous upholding of the law that will earn our freedom. It's mostly a political movement more than it is a religious. It's diverse and conflicted. There's a great scene where Vespasian and Titus are about to besiege Jerusalem. And there's so much civil war happening in Jerusalem with the various zealot movements fighting each other and burning the food supply within Jerusalem just before the siege that Vespasian basically says, what's the point of attacking the Jews while they're busy killing themselves? That these zealot groups are often warring against one another as much as they are Rome because they are so zealous in their view. And you get groups like the Sicarii, which is a sort of assassin group who are basically going around assassinating political leaders. Or there's a passage in Josephus where it talks about Sicarii had taken over Masada, and because they were running out of supplies, they attacked the Jewish community and decimated all the Jews in En-Gedi. So they basically are wiping out Jews as well, just because they're opposed to basically anybody that's not them. The image you get is of it turning into kind of chaos in those last days as so many of these groups become violent against each other. I won't read through all these because we're out of time, but you get mentions of zealots. So in Acts 5, you get the mention of Judas the Galilean, who rose up one of these revolutions. In Acts 21, an Egyptian who had recently stirred up a revolt and led 4,000 these assassins. You get some of Jesus's followers who are described specifically, Simon, who was called the Zealot. Or the two criminals who were hung with Jesus are called robbers. It's probably better revolutionaries. They're basically, Josephus will use this same Greek word to talk about the zealots sometimes. So they're probably some of these revolutionary radical zealots. Last question. I want to draw three kind of conclusions before I leave a little time for questions, and I know we're done. What do you do with Jesus in the midst of this? What was Jesus? Was Jesus a Sadducee, a Pharisee, an Essene, a zealot? Three things I would take away from this. Jesus is sometimes imagined as being hostile or opposed to the Jews. This will go around, right? That Jesus is sort of like against the temple. Jesus is against the practice of Judaism. It can even sometimes become sort of anti-Semitic. The Jews were the ones who killed Jesus. I think to read the New Testament in the context of the first century world is to recognize that it's way more complicated than that. That Jesus is a Jew, that Jesus is practicing Judaism, and Jesus is very much in conversation with these conversations happening within Judaism. And to say that any person was opposed to the Jews is almost a statement you can't make. You know, I'm opposed to Americans. Well, which Americans? Because I bet there's a lot here you would agree with as well, right? This is the view of Judaism in the time of Jesus. It is massively diverse in how it's addressing some of these questions, and Jesus is in the middle of these questions. Number two, and I made this point earlier, to really understand the Gospels and Jesus, you have to at least have some awareness of these conversations that are going on, right? When you encounter the Sadducees asking about resurrection, when you encounter Jesus bringing up these common debates or conversations around the law and oral tradition, to have a little bit of understanding of that, you suddenly realize Jesus is entering into these conversations versus these conversations just sort of strangely emerging in the middle of nowhere. And number three, the Christian practices also emerge out of these conversations. A lot of the things that seem to stand out about Christianity, whether it's water baptism, whether it is the rejection of sacrifice in the temple, the more you study the first century, the more you begin to realize that these threads are beginning to form, that Christ and the Christians make a definitive statement about these things. They have a view on these things. But these aren't, the reason I say this, these aren't 400 or 500 years later, scribes writing these Christian doctrines back into the Gospels. you can read the Gospels and they very much fit and make sense in the conversations and the development, the Jewish questions that are forming in the first century. What you really get when you read the Gospels is you get a view of those conversations in the world that really locks in and fit with all of the other sources we have about what was going on in the first century, that they very much do. Not that any of us were questioning it. I think we're people in the room who believe in the accuracy of the New Testament. But more than anything else, they lock into everything else we know about the first century and seem like documents written by people who are a part of these conversations in the first century who understand this world. So that's a quick overview. Sadducees, Pharisees, Essenes, a little on zealots. We're out of time. I'm welcome to let you go. Or if you've got a couple questions, I'm happy to answer those as well too.